From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Today, senators are hearing closing arguments for and against the removal of President Trump for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. A vote to acquit the president is expected on Wednesday. Last night, in a Fox News interview before the Super Bowl, the president was asked if he'd delay tomorrow night's State of the Union address.
No. I'm going to have it. It's going to be done. We're going to talk about the achievements that we've made. Nobody's made achievements like we've made so many different things.
Joining us now with the latest is Tim Mak, who covers politics and national security for NPR. And Tim, on Friday, it wasn't immediately clear what was next for this trial. How do you expect it to go today?
Well, we're expecting to hear closing arguments for both the president's defense team and the House impeachment managers. And they're going to probably lay it out over the course of the afternoon. And then senators will have a chance they haven't had over the course of the trial. They'll have the chance to speak over the next couple of days. Senators have been forced to sit in their seats and be silent over the course of much of the trial. And now they'll have some time until Wednesday at 4 p.m. when we expect a final vote on acquittal. They'll have some time over the next couple of days to explain their positions on witnesses and on the impeachment trial more generally.
We've been able to hear some of them today. Here's House impeachment manager Jason Crow in opening arguments for removing Trump from office.
I submit to you on behalf of the House of Representatives that your duty demands that you convict President Trump.
What are you hearing about former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who, of course, claims to have firsthand information that President Trump held up Ukraine's military aid in exchange for an investigation of Joe Biden? Is that debate over? From hearing from him.
Right. Of course, the Senate declined to hear from John Bolton when it voted against witnesses on Friday.
Yeah.
And Congressman Adam Schiff, who's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, he's also the lead manager in the for the impeachment articles, he declined to say whether or not his committee might take an active role in subpoenaing John Bolton going forward. He was on CBS's Face the Nation over the weekend, and he said he did not want to comment, but he said that the truth would come out, right? That John Bolton has a book that's expected to be published in March. It's now going through a declassification or a classification national security review. And it's possible that the House could go ahead and subpoena John Bolton if it decided to take that step.
Yeah, I want to ask you about something else. More Republicans are now saying that even though they are set to acquit President Trump, they are acknowledging his actions were wrong or inappropriate. Here's Iowa Senator Joni Ernst on CNN with Jake Tapper yesterday.
Probably not something that I would have done.
It's wrong?
He's done it now. The president has a lot of latitude to do what he wants to do.
We also heard from Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, who said something similar, and he believes that the American people are the best to make the final decision on Trump's fate. Is this the consensus among Republicans, this argument?
There's a big variety of reactions and defenses for the president among Republican senators. Some will say, as Senator Lamar Alexander has said, that there's misconduct here, but it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. Some will say, as Senator Ernst said in that clip that you played, I wouldn't do it that way, but I'm not quite ready to say he committed misconduct. And still others will say in the Senate that the president did nothing wrong and everything was perfect and fine with both his July 25th call and all the elements surrounding the impeachment articles.
Yeah. As I said at the top, that the president will hold his State of the Union address. What do we expect to hear from him?
Well, it will be a very obviously political speech. He's running for re-election, and he's the first president to give a State of the Union address while running for re-election and under an active impeachment trial. So you can expect him to talk about what he believes to be his accomplishments. And I suspect he'll probably take a little time to mention the trial, which from all appearances, he's expected to be acquitted on later this week.
That's Tim Mak. He covers politics and national security for NPR. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, there are now 11 cases of the new coronavirus in the U.S., but more than 17,200 confirmed cases in China and at least 361 deaths there, entire provinces closed off. Let's get the view from American Nick Kaufman, a Fulbright student in China since August, studying economic development in rural Anhui province, which borders Hubei province, where the outbreak began in the city of Wuhan. The Fulbright program has sent students emails saying they've temporarily suspended the program in China and they should leave the country. And Nick, you say as you move around, say, university campuses, there are people doing medical checks, taking your temperature.
Yeah, I think that that's something not only at the universities, but going to a museum, or which have actually recently been shut down, so you can't do that anymore, but going on a subway or going to the train station, or every now and then in transit, there will be a sporadic stop just to make sure you're not running a fever. So pretty much everywhere you go, they will check your temperature if you're going into a place that's frequented by other people. Huh. And then at restaurants, for example, I think it must be a city order because most, if not all, are not open to customers to come sit down in. They let you order there, and a lot of them will have you wait outside, and then a woman or a man in a mask will come out and hand you your food. It's actually been a bit of a boom for the local delivery men. So you've seen them kind of congregating out front of various restaurants picking up orders for Chinese citizens that just don't really want to go outside or interact with other folks. So it's been a boom in a business for them, but I don't think they're, you know, too joyful for the reasons behind it.
Yeah. When did you first hear about this virus, and how has that knowledge changed in the last few weeks?
The virus in mainland China kept a pretty low profile, I'd say, through most of the month of December and early January. The first time I found out about it, I was actually traveling to Hong Kong on research. And I took the train from Guangzhou down to Hong Kong, and there was just a wall of what I presume must have been Hong Kong doctors or medical professionals scanning everybody with body temperature checks and asking about our travel history. And I remember kind of like looking around and thinking, like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And then, of course, over the next couple of weeks, it certainly escalated on the mainland and people became more aware of it.
Are you frightened?
Yeah, I mean, I am aware that the severity rate for people my age, I'm 23 years old, isn't as high of a risk. And when I talk with a lot of the students in Anhui who are Chinese, I think the real kind of fear that you get is these students are very nervous about their grandparents or older members of their family. In China, there's such a culture of respect for grandparents and filial piety already. And then in Anhui, since it's a pretty rural province, a lot of these students' parents went to the cities to work as migrant workers. So these students were being raised by their grandparents and have very, very close relationships with them. So they're very worried about if their grandparents get sick and they're already in a region without the best medical facilities compared to Shanghai or Beijing. Yeah. I think that's where the real fear is manifesting itself among students in my province.
Well, fear is one thing, but panic would be another. Now, we know the Lunar New Year holiday was extended to keep people away from work and businesses longer, you know, keep them home longer. In your area, are you seeing people, you know, who live there wanting to leave? Are you seeing people looking for face masks? Are you getting a sense that people are moving from that, you know, concern area to something else?
I would hesitate to call it panic. I think there is a high level of concern and a little bit of fear. I think the a concern with Hubei is they did close off a lot of public transportation and subway. I think it's important to remember that a lot of young Chinese don't drive, and a lot of them are very reliant on public transportation to get to where they need to go. So people do certainly see a big concern in their hometowns if they get caught up in these lockdowns. Mm-hmm. I did take a train before the severity of the virus really kind of came out. And even at that point, I was the only person on my train. And this is, again, this is over the Lunar New Year, which is the highest travel season in China. It's hundreds and millions of people. The young men and women that sell snacks and drinks off the trolleys up and down the train aisles, I've never seen move that fast because they weren't selling anything. And one of the men was just chatting with me, and he was saying that he's kind of relieved that the trains are so empty because that means that he's not communicating with people and not at risk of catching the virus.
Yeah. Well, and Nick Kaufman, you're heading out of Anhui province, where you are in China. You're heading to Taiwan. What kind of protections are you going to take when you travel?
So I'm going to be going through all kinds of medical screenings and checks and consistent temperature checks. When issues like this do spring up in China, frequently they'll put up large red banners. Three slogans I've seen in particular. The first is Bu Shi Ye Wei, which says, do not eat wild animals. And the second and third is Fang Fang Bing Du, Bao Hu Zi Ji He Jia Ren, which would translate to combat or prevent the virus, protect yourself and family. And so there's all kinds of precautions being taken. So on a personal level, I'm fortunate to be going through lots of medical checks and making sure that I'm safe. And then on a more macro scale, they've been very clear in their advice of what they want students to do and what they want them to avoid.
That's Nick Kaufman, Fulbright student researcher in Anhui Province, China. The Fulbright program has been temporarily suspended. He's going to be leaving that area. But Nick, thanks for your observations and stay safe.
Thank you, Robin.
NPR's Code Switch is a podcast about race in America that's about all of us. Our histories, how we're represented, the ways we've worked together and worked against each other. You'll learn, you might get mad, you'll definitely laugh, but don't take my word for it. Just listen to NPR's Code Switch.
The Iowa caucuses are tonight, and recent polls predict turnout by young voters could swing the outcome. Back in 2016, young voters propelled Bernie Sanders to a virtual tie with Hillary Clinton in Iowa. This year, Sanders is competing with a number of candidates for that demographic. And as Here and Now's Chris Bentley reports, their vote could prove decisive.
We shouldn't bother doing it.
We don't have 400 voter registration sheets.
Yeah. Because I think if we go door to door.
Send an email.
But we have the QR codes on our phones.
Yeah.
We
can
also. I don't know. Classes haven't yet begun at Iowa City High School. And eight members of the caucus club are planning their final push to get out the vote. Anyone eligible to vote in November can caucus tonight, even if they haven't turned 18 yet. And the caucus club hopes all of them will. It's time for class, but a few students stick around. Tonight will be their first time caucusing, and senior Daphne Noop says she's nervous.
I'm intimidated because I'm afraid of crowds. I don't do a lot of political speaking, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm really scared. But, you know, it'll happen.
Noop says she'll face those fears to support Pete Buttigieg, the youngest candidate in the race. Maria Burry is still deciding between Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. But she will definitely caucus, and she thinks many of her classmates will too.
At City High, I felt that there's a pretty big shift in the amount of people who are just talking about political issues that affect them day to day. I mean, with gun violence, school shootings, climate change, I just think there's always something just that really affects them and they really do care about.
Just a, like Google form that you can just put your question in your email and then we email them.
Those issues are also motivating young voters a few miles away at the University of Iowa, which counts more than 33,000 students.
Okay, we're going to get super hyped up. Are you ready? I know it's a small group. Okay, caucusing.
Jocelyn Ruff is trying to get some of her fellow Hawkeyes psyched up about caucusing. She's executive director of Hawk the Vote, a nonpartisan student group trying to boost turnout among young people. They're answering questions over social media and at in-person sessions and holding a mock caucus on campus to get first-time voters comfortable with what can be a confusing process. That's important because young people typically vote at lower rates than older generations. But the 2018 midterm election saw an increase in youth turnout in Iowa, according to state election data. And Ruff predicts another uptick this year.
The sense I'm getting is that there's really a culture shift in young people and they're excited about voting. It's not only your responsibility and your civic duty, which sounds kind of scary and alienating, but it's also the best way that you can make an impact on the things that you care about in a tangible way.
Young people can definitely swing this election.
Courtney Julick is a PhD candidate at the University of Iowa studying young voters.
If they turn out at 18%, which is not far off from what older people turn out, which is usually like in the low 20s, they can definitely swing the election. And we've seen that happen with Obama's surprising win out in 2008 in the caucuses here in Iowa. And then again with Bernie Sanders almost virtually tying Clinton, which was also very unexpected. And those were motivated by the youth turning out and voting for these specific candidates.
As the sun goes down over a snow-covered campus, volunteers for the Bernie Sanders campaign dial away in a phone banking session at the University of Iowa Student Union. They're trying to expand Sanders' voter base by mobilizing people who may have expressed support for him on social media or to a campaign volunteer, but haven't yet committed to caucus tonight.
Hi, my name is Finn. I'm a volunteer with the Bernie Sanders for Iowa campaign.
The volunteers emphasize Sanders' proposal to cancel student debt, as well as his plans for healthcare and the environment, three issues that polls show young voters rank highly. Zoe Swinton is president of the student group Hawks for Bernie.
Young voters feel a lot of pressure because this feels like our last chance. I mean, with Bernie, it is our last chance, right? Like, I don't think he's going to run again. But this is something that we need, and we need it right now, and we can't have another 4 years with no change.
In 2016, Sanders won more than 80% of Iowa caucus-goers between the ages of 18 and 29. But this time, Sanders has more competition. At a town hall event for Joe Biden at the University of Iowa last week, 20-year-old Madison Burke said she's leaning towards caucusing for the former vice president.
Well, for me personally, I think that experience in office is huge. So I think that Biden's a great candidate because he has that experience, and that makes me feel safe.
But Burke says she's also considering Elizabeth Warren and Andrew Yang. A few seats down at the same Biden event, 27-year-old Van Yeager's candidate of choice is clear, from his hat reading math to his Yang 2020 sweatpants. He came from Florida to volunteer for Yang and says he's been canvassing voters around Johnson County.
When we tell them, yeah, there's a caucus coming up, there's a guy who wants to give you $1,000 a month, their eyes, like, light up and they're like, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And then hopefully we can shock some people here in Iowa.
Yang got more votes than any other Democratic candidate in this year's Iowa Youth Straw Poll, a statewide survey of more than 27,000 young voters released last week. But the big question for any campaign relying on young voters is whether they'll actually show up tonight to caucus. A Circle Tisch College and Suffolk University poll released last month found 35% of Iowa voters ages 18 to 29 say they are extremely likely to caucus. If that holds true, it would be a historic year for youth turnout in Iowa, and one where young voters could make or break a Democratic candidate's campaign in what polls show is still a very tight race. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley.
President Trump's new expansion of immigration restrictions on six countries could have devastating impacts on Africa's largest economic center, Nigeria. Nigerians make up the largest population of Africans living in the United States, and historically, the U.S. has been a trading partner and an ally to Nigeria. Under this new policy, Nigerians will no longer be able to apply for visas to immigrate to the U.S. permanently. For more, we're joined by Yemi Kowejo, president of the Nigerian American Multicultural Council. She's based in Houston, but is joining us from Lagos, Nigeria. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello, Tonya. I'm glad to be here.
Yemi, what's been the reaction to this ban from Nigerian communities, both here in the U.S. and there in Nigeria?
Well, it, of course, came as a surprise to us. And also, we were a little bit concerned, disappointed that Nigeria would be included in the ban. Family means a lot to us, and we enjoy having all our family members around us. So the first reaction is the separation this will cause to family members and the hardship that will follow.
Because this ban prohibits bringing family to the States.
Yes, it does, since it doesn't prohibit visitors, you know, short-term visits, but the longer-term ones, which is usually family, children filing for their parents to come join them, or spouses filing for each other, siblings. That's what we see this ban affecting. And this is where we are kind of grappling with what are these implications, especially for the next generation Nigerians.
Nigeria is also the most populous country on the continent of Africa, and it's also a very important economy globally. Nearly 8,000 immigrant visas were issued to Nigerians in 2018 to the U.S., Russia and China are investing and partnering heavily in Nigeria. You were a longtime ExxonMobil executive. It's what brought you to Houston. How significant, from your view, is this ban to Nigeria's economy and really losses for the U.S.?
Well, part of what I see here is that it certainly will make business more difficult, and especially, again, part of the loss I see to the U.S. is the loss in talents. You know, these bans will reduce the kind of talents that will show up in the U.S. because once things are getting too difficult, you would look for other places if you do want to go somewhere else. The ban gives an impression of being not as inclusive as we all see the U.S. as. So maybe, you know, people will look for other options. And there are other options all over the world. So it will be the loss of the U.S. invariably.
The Department of Homeland Security says Nigeria failed to meet minimum security requirements. The president of Nigeria says the government will be working to fix those security lapses. But do you think your current president, Buhari's policies are responsible for lowering Nigeria's standards around the world?
We did read that there is a task force set up to look into these gaps and see how quickly to fix them. So we're hoping in the near future these gaps will be fixed and that then the ban will be revoked. Just like the Homeland Security said, I believe Chad was one of the countries which they have revoked the ban. So we do hope that whatever measures are required from the Nigerian government's side of the equation will be resolved.
You're in Nigeria right now visiting family and work duties. How are your friends and family there processing the news?
You know, when things are such that you probably can't do much about it, you have to start thinking of all the alternatives, you know. So it's like, well, maybe the U.S. is not the place to go, and people are disappointed, and it's still a bit fresh, I must say. So even all the other alternatives are still not quite clear in people's mind on what next to do. We're just all hoping that it's going to be temporary and that we'll be able to go back to business as usual sooner than later.
That's Yemi Koejo. She is president of the Nigerian American Multicultural Council, and she joins us from Lagos, Nigeria. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Now second and six. Williams makes a cut and will roll into the end zone for the touchdown. No flags.
The final touchdown of last night's gripping Super Bowl battle between the San Francisco 49ers and the Kansas City Chiefs. That's how it sounded in Miami. Here's how it sounded in the Kansas City Power and Light District, where thousands of fans watched on a big screen. Led by quarterback Patrick Mahomes, Kansas City surged back from a 10-point deficit to win their first Super Bowl in 50 years, Coach Andy Reid's first Super Bowl victory ever. Final score, 31-20. Kyle Palmer of KCUR still up. Kyle, explain what this means for Missouri and Kansas City.
Yeah, I haven't gone to bed.
Right, we'll say. Right.
It's a huge win. It's the first time in 50 years that the Chiefs have won a Super Bowl, as one fan put it last night, a cornerstone of the city, this franchise and team, which has been here since the early 1960s, and really a powerhouse team in the early days of the NFL, but have gone through some struggles in more recent decades and had some really heartbreaking playoff losses and disappointments over the years. I should know. I'm a lifelong Chiefs mm-hmm. fan, grew up here. But yeah, last night, I think for a lot of fans, was the culmination of a rebuilding project with Andy Reid as coach and Patrick Mahomes as quarterback, and really it felt right in the way that it happened with the comeback in the fourth quarter.
Well, we want to talk about some of those elements, but first, let's get this out of the way. President Trump tweeted after the victory, congratulating the Chiefs for representing the great state of Kansas so very well. Kansas City, this team, both live in the great state of Missouri. You know, how are people taking that in, or is that just a nothing burger?
I will say Kansas Cityans are used to national figures mixing up exactly where the city is. So it is a bipartisan problem, if you want to put it that way. And I think most reasonable-minded Metro residents probably took it with a grain of salt. To be fair, there is a Kansas City, Kansas,
right.
just across the river. But the Kansas City that you think of and the Chiefs and Jazz and barbecue, that is Kansas City, Missouri.
That's right. But you could take a Sharpie and just kind of circle the state. Anyway, look, Patrick Mahomes, the quarterback, only third African-American quarterback to win a Super Bowl in the history of the game. So young in his 20s, so new to the team. I mean, people might not realize he was the Chiefs' first-round draft pick in 2017. Just talk a little bit about how this city's embracing him.
Yeah, he's quickly become probably, outside of the likes of George Brett and Len Dawson, maybe already at 24, the most beloved figure in Kansas City sports history. And certainly last night's win and the fact that he was MVP and helped lead their comeback in the fourth quarter cements that even more. Just a couple of things to note about how adored he is. There's a special cereal being sold in a local grocery store around here called Mahomes Magic Crunch. It's like a Frosted Flakes type cereal. Mm. And the local grocery store chain Hy-Vee says they're expecting to sell 300,000 boxes of that this season. Another thing, a story that was posted to Twitter, don't know if it's true or not. I haven't verified it, but it kind of speaks to the love that Kansas City has for this young man. Said that him and his girlfriend went out to eat at a local restaurant, that they weren't bothered. And when he left, he announced to the room, you know, thank you so much for letting us enjoy our dinner in peace, and walked out. And then the restaurant told everyone that they had paid for everyone's meal.
Oh, man, I want to move to Kansas City. By the way, sorry, 49ers fans. Maybe next year. But that's Kyle Palmer of KCUR there in Kansas City, Missouri. Kyle, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Today, we launch a series on what some are calling the silencing of science under the Trump administration. A National Parks scientist receiving a cease and desist letter after testifying to Congress about climate change. Sharpiegate, when President Trump falsely claimed that Alabama was in the path of Hurricane Dorian. Emails just obtained by BuzzFeed showed that at that time, officials at the National Weather Service and National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration were writing each other saying things like, help, and yep, crazy. The Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University's Law School has been tracking this erosion of science, of truth, with a special tracker called the Silencing Science Tracker. Michael Gerard, director of the Sabin Center, joins us. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And you actually have two trackers there. One focuses just on climate change deregulation, rolling back of a lot of regulation. But the other one, this Silencing Science Tracker, what prompted that?
We saw that as soon as Trump was inaugurated, he started talking even more loudly about disregarding science. We saw that percolate throughout the federal government, and we decided to keep track of it so that they would be held accountable. People would know what they're doing.
Well, and we will hook people up. You can go right now to hearandnow.org. And just scanning through, I mean, here's a recent entry on the tracker for December 24th. Online pollution tracking database removed. Just tell us more. Land on that one.
So the National Library of Medicine, which is part of the National Institute of Medicine, for a long time had a website called ToxMap, where you could look at any particular location in the country and see if there were any Superfund sites or polluting factories or other sources of pollution that were there, so that if you were thinking about moving to a particular place, for example, you could see what's around. They have taken that down. They've eliminated the site. The data are still available in obscure places that you have to hunt for, but the general public no longer has easy access to this information about the sources of pollution in the communities where they live or might want to move.
I'm just picking out a few more. The Trump administration acts as federal advisory committee focused on invasive species. White House strikes climate change language from vehicle emissions proposal. When you see it all together like this in the tracker, it's pretty overwhelming.
They no longer are interested in expertise, or at least the kind of expertise that might lead to conclusions that they dislike. As you said, they've been eliminating a lot of the scientific advisory committees, and those that have survived, they've kicked off many of the academic scientists and put in place industry representatives.
What are you hearing from people in the government agencies?
There's an enormous amount of distress by the career staff. You have a lot of dedicated, very sophisticated scientists and other professionals who've been devoting their careers to keeping us safe from pollution and unsafe products and so forth, and they're being squelched. Some of them are leaving if they have other opportunities. And I'm also seeing at my own university that many young scientists are deciding they don't want to go to work for the federal government. That's not a congenial place to actually carry out good science anymore.
Well, here's another item from June 24th of last year. Studies showing damages from climate change buried by the USDA. Scientists at the USDA claim that the agency has deliberately failed to publicize research publications that address the impact of climate change. So again, people within agencies reporting this. But we mentioned in the introduction that one national park scientist got a cease and desist letter. Is the government allowed to do that? Tell people they can't speak about this?
Well, they can tell their employees that they shouldn't appear at certain events or write certain kinds of articles. And that's been happening increasingly. And so scientists who work for the government are told not to appear at professional conferences. They can still reply to subpoenas. But in general, the gag orders for federal employees tend to be effective.
Yeah. One of the items people will remember, it reads, on three separate occasions in September, President Trump stated that Alabama was under threat from Hurricane Dorian, even though no government weather forecast predicted any impact would be felt in the state. And we remember the Sharpie that drew on a whiteboard map, including roping Alabama into a forecast when it didn't belong there. Why do you think this is not making a bigger impact?
Because there's so much else happening out there. There's so much noise out there in the world. But in this particular instance, the emergency responders in Alabama who listened to this unnecessarily took precautions and scrambled and so forth, whereas the places where the hurricane was actually going may have relaxed their diligence. It's also very dispiriting to the professionals in the Weather Bureau, which has traditionally been a completely non-political agency, but here people are trying to mess with their results.
Well, and as you know, President Trump has always said that government regulations have stifled business, and that's his, you know, he's in the business of business and jobs in the economy, and that the government is bloated, and many in his base believe that. Could this just be trimming regulatory fat?
But of course, that is true for the coal industry, for example, but there are lots of other businesses that are badly hurt by climate change. If your business is flooded or transportation is disrupted because of extreme weather events or the other kinds of things that are happening increasingly as a result of climate change, the wildfires and the hurricanes and the extreme rains and so forth, those businesses are really hurt. So it's only a very small slice of the economy that is helped by this deregulation. Much larger portions of it are hurt.
Well, and I was talking, too, about the cost of the agencies that are controlling a lot of these issues. And a lot of President Trump supporters feel that that work should be outsourced, that it should be in the private sector and not paid for by taxpayer dollars. You say what?
Well, if it is paid for by industry dollars and by the industries that don't want the negative impacts to be revealed, then, you know, you get what you pay for. And it's much more economical to society to have independent, objective science.
What has jumped out at you? I mentioned the Alabama, you know, Sharpie squiggle. But what are some that have jumped out at you as you've tracked them?
How pervasive it is, how every time that a climate scientist wants to raise his or her head above the foxhole, they're intimidated or they're shot down by it. One particularly egregious example is that a lot of the standards for certain kinds of air pollution are based on longstanding epidemiological studies, and they show that certain kinds of pollution are very bad for health. There's a new proposal that would block the use of those kinds of studies because they call it transparency, but what they really want is the medical records of the individuals who were studied in the epidemiological studies. That, of course, violates patient confidentiality. It's just an elaborate ruse to avoid using these very important and well-accepted peer-reviewed studies.
We should say that in some parts of the government, science is flourishing. NASA is one example that's always given, and the National Institutes of Health has had increases. Does this seem to be largely about the science around climate?
Well, it's the science around climate and also environmental protection in general. It's the science that could have the effect of costing more money or reducing the profits of certain sectors of the economy. NASA science doesn't do that, and so NASA science isn't endangered. But parts of the National Institutes of Health do that, like the ToxMap site that they took down, and so those are vulnerable.
Yeah, well, what do you think I'm asking you a question that I know the answer to. I mean, what's the effect of this at a time when, you know, we're supposed to be ramping up our knowledge of the impact of climate and the environment?
One of the things that has made America great is the brilliance of our science. All of this is really putting America behind. There are other countries that don't have this new disregard for science. It is disabling the U.S. from advancing technologically, and much of that technological advancement is a basis for a lot of our economic prosperity. It's also inhibiting our ability to anticipate and prepare for the negative impacts of climate change that we know are coming.
But what happens in a country where people are told not to believe empirical science? I mean, what happens?
This is beyond Orwell. People had no conception that there would be such disregard of truth and facts and knowledge and information and expertise. They're all being thrown under the bus, and the country will be much poorer for it.
Michael Girard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. We've been talking about the silencing science tracker they've developed. We'll hook you up at hereandnow.org. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And also this week, we'll take a closer look at the EPA, the Department of Agriculture, silencing science here and now.
This year's census numbers are being watched closely here in California. That's because the state may lose its first congressional seat in history, thanks to a decline in population. Many people are leaving California for less expensive states to the north and southeast, like Idaho and Texas. And those places are now grappling with the influx of population. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. And Derek, I want to start with some of the reaction from the places Californians are moving to. In October, Wayne Ritchie, a candidate for mayor in Boise, joked about building a wall around the state to stop Californians from coming in. He didn't end up winning, of course, but he brings up a sentiment that others might be feeling, right?
Yes, it's a popular sentiment out west, and it's not just Boise. There was a viral Wall Street Journal article about another small Idaho town that felt like it was buckling under the stress of thousands of inbound Californians. In Texas, it's largely the same thing. There are all these stories bemoaning the arrival of Californians. It's practically become a cliche, and in fact, yeah. The governor of Texas recently issued a warning on Twitter where he essentially said, when you come here from Southern California, leave your high-tax habits and liberal ways in California. So what you see across the West, I think, is this sense that they're being overrun by a California diaspora.
And yet you argue that this idea that there's a mass exodus from California may be overblown. What do the numbers tell us?
I do think it's overblown. There is so much talk in the media about a California exodus today that surely something is changing, and it is. In 2012, California grew by about 110,000 movers. That's both American movers and immigrants. Last year, California lost 40,000 people on net to migration. So if you look at sort of those two data points, you're like, oh, well, it's an exodus. But when you talk to state demographers, as I did, what they'll say is it's unfair to compare 2020 to 2012, which was really a high watermark for California adding people. If you pull back the lens further, if you look at, say, the last 40 years of people moving in and out of California, what's happening now just isn't that dramatic when it comes to migration. The number of outbound Californians, for example, in 2018 was really no higher than it was in the mid-2000s, really perhaps lower than it was in the mid-1990s. So if this is an exodus, then California is in kind of a semi-permanent state of biblical exodus, and we shouldn't be freaking out about it today.
Yeah, you know, I lived in Seattle for 10 years, and the whole time I was there, I kept hearing about Californians coming in and changing Seattle and Washington State. So why do you think there is a backlash, particularly now?
I think For two reasons. The first has to do with politics. Texas, for example, is on the cusp, I think, from flipping from a deep ruby red conservative state to a more mixed purple state with blue Democratic metros and red rural areas. And in that context, the next family from California that moves to like Plano, Texas, isn't just some new family that has slightly different taste in barbecue that you can learn to get along with. They're potentially the demographic straw that could break the GOP's back in Texas. So people are afraid of that political swap. Number two, I think, is that Californians really are moving to some different places. For example, Idaho really wasn't on the top of the list for a lot of outbound Californians, but now it is. The number of people moving from California to Idaho doubled in the last 6 years, even though overall migration out of California didn't change that much. So it's A, a bit of politics, and B, a bit of, I would say, distribution. Californians are moving to slightly different places.
Yeah, Idaho in particular is really interesting because it's not nearly as populous as a place like Texas. How is this big shift changing a place like Idaho?
Well, we have to use the big H word, housing. I think a lot of the moves both into California and out of California are about employment and housing. And right now with unemployment relatively low, a lot of families are making their decision where to live based on housing prices. And housing prices have just gone absolutely nuts in California recently. The average home value in Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco has increased respectively by 70%. 80% and 120% since the end of the Great Recession.
Wow.
Just absolutely soared. And as a result, a lot of families that may have gotten a start, maybe even immigrant families that got a start in those coastal metros, now that they want to lay down roots and start a family that builds in the U.S., they're thinking, we can't do that in Los Angeles or San Diego.
Yeah.
We have to leave. So where do they see as a place with jobs, with land, with cheaper housing? Well, Idaho is right there.
And where does that leave California ultimately?
I think the fear for California shouldn't necessarily just be exodus. It should be genesis. That is, it's about not just the people who are leaving, but the children who aren't arriving. What you see in California is that middle-class families are leaving. They're having their first or second kid somewhere else. Births are falling. Fertility is declining across the country, including for Latinos, who make up about a third of that state's population. And as a result, as I write in the piece, the Golden State is becoming richer, more exclusive, a slightly more opulent shade of gray as its median age grows up. The Golden State is slowly turning platinum, and that is something that demographers are absolutely worried about.
Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.